Montana is home to 7 Indian reservations and a dozen tribal nations, and the sport of basketball has a unique home among them all. UM professor Wade Davies researched for nearly 2 decades before publishing Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball, 1895 to 1970. And he joins us to talk about that history of the sport amongst the tribes across the nation over the past 100 years and how our Native American brothers and sisters have put their own stamp on a sport that is uniquely American. I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana. Thanks for clicking on and subscribing to the many and varied podcasts from Voices of Montana. Contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com if you like. This podcast is sponsored by Montana's Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, reminding hunters that we're all stewards of this incredible resource and that ethical hunting ensures that we get to keep doing what we love. Please remember, respect land, landowners, wildlife, pass it on. More at fwp.mt.gov/pass it on. Here's our deep dive on Native Hoops with UM Professor Wade Davies. Professor Davies, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Congratulations on the award. I think that's a big thing from the Western History Association, the John C. Ewers Award. I mean, I didn't necessarily mean to start there, but I mean, that's pretty high recognition because John C. Ewers is, I call him the grandfather of a study of Native American history, but he helped establish the National Museum of American History and became its director in 1964. Congratulations on that recognition, sir.
Hey, thank you very much. I mean, that it was wonderful to get. I was happy to hear about it, and yeah.
Well, and it didn't come without a little bit of work. 2 decades in researching this. Why did you go back to 1895? I guess that's my first question. It goes 1895 to 1970. What was pivotal about that year?
Well, the reason is the purpose of the book is to explore why basketball became the phenomenon it is in Indian country today. And so I took it back to the very beginning, tried to find the very first year that Native peoples anywhere in the United States played the sport. And 1895 is, to the best of my knowledge, the first year that any Native peoples played basketball. It was a women's team at Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, which were the first to take it up. So that's my starting point. And then I took it through to around 1970 because I'm trying to trace the development of that sport from where its roots were, mostly in the boarding schools, and then followed that as it spread from there out in every direction and eventually made it to the home communities and became a reservation sport in its own right.
Professor,
so that's why the time period.
Going back there again, what did you find significant about that origin?
That basketball from the very beginning. So these boarding schools where students first learned about it for many Native people was a traumatic experience, not for everybody, but for many it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd been taken from their community and taken from their own roots. And Native communities have a very, very rich athletic tradition going back to the dawn of time. I mean, many sports that they played traditionally, lacrosse being the most well-known, but many others as well. And they'd been taken from these traditions, taken from their families. They were suffering from homesickness at best and deeper trauma at worst. And they were introduced to, I guess you would say, non-Native sports, football, baseball, and basketball. But in these sports, they kind of turned them on their head, and they found a way to assert their own identities through it and to be Native and to form communities with other students. And so those sports, all of those sports, became a very important part of surviving that experience. And basketball had a special place because for a couple of reasons. One, it was the only one of those major sports that was both boys and girls. So one of its powers in Indian country to this day is that it has that much broader appeal. both genders and so on. And the other reason is that basketball had some elements in it that were very reminiscent of a lot of the traditional sports. And that's not entirely coincidental, because James Naismith, who invented basketball, wrote the rules for it, 1891 in the winter, in Springfield, in the YMCA in Massachusetts. He was a Canadian, and he'd grown up much of his life playing lacrosse, was a lover of lacrosse. And when he invented basketball, as he explained, he had elements in there from sports that he knew before. There's an element of soccer in there. There's an element of other sports. But one of those was lacrosse, that the way he positioned the players, his choice of a goal that you're scoring on, which seems pretty basic, but in his mind, a lot of that was influenced by lacrosse. And so Native peoples wouldn't have known that at the time in the 1890s, but there's that root that's in there. So it has some indigenous roots in its DNA. So when they started playing that sport, it caught on like wildfire.
It's a pretty cool part of this story as well. Professor Wade Davies is with us, Native American Studies, University of Montana. That's the College of Humanities and Sciences and Department of History. It is Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball, 1895 to 1970. Again, I'm kind of going back to 1895, as you had talked about that boarding school, that girls' team. For most of America, girls' basketball didn't catch on for many, many years later. Did you find that significant?
Yeah, well, actually, what's interesting is that that's only partially true. So initially, basketball was big amongst women. So from the very beginning, so Naismith invented it as a men's sport, but there was a women's college nearby, and some staff and students from that college came and saw it being played in Springfield, and it caught on in women's colleges across the country in the 1890s and into the early 1900s. And that's partially how it made its way to a lot of these Indian boarding schools, they called it, that the federal government ran, because students at these schools and staff members saw it played in the YMCA in various parts of the country. And they saw it as both a men's and women's sport. In fact, some places it was a women's sport more so early. In Montana, one of the first teams to ever play, if not the first team to ever play basketball, was the women's team at Fort Shaw Indian School. And so in some states, like Montana, it would have initially been seen as a women's sport, interestingly enough. But then after 1920 and through the 30s and 40s, as high school athletic associations rose conferences within the college ranks, women's basketball was largely wiped out, in part because there were concerns about it, how it would affect women's body. There were concerns about exploiting women. There were various groups that were pushing for that. So it ceased to be a women's sport for decades before it came back. Interesting. But it didn't start that way.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that education there. I just know that in Montana, as I began, and I go back a few years, we didn't even have state championships till it was probably I don't remember, but it was after 1950, maybe 1970-something, when we had actually state championships in Montana. You mentioned the Fort Shaw Indians, and I know that there are people out there going, talk about Fort Shaw, because that's a huge story in these parts.
Sure, yeah. And there hadn't been much written on this topic at all before my book, with the exception, a really notable exception, a few exceptions. But one is the book that Linda Peavy and Ursula Smith wrote on the Fort Shaw girls team and them winning the state championship of Montana in 1903 and then the world's championship in 1904. So in 1904, this team of young women that were attending Fort Shaw boarding school in Montana, they went to the World's Fair in St. Louis, and they were there in part to advertise federal Indian policy and the boarding schools to the broader public, all the great things that were supposedly being done in these schools to Americanize Native peoples. And so they were there doing many things, but they also were a basketball team. And their school superintendent and coach, Fred Campbell, then put together a lot of match games for them with whoever, whatever takers they could find there in St. Louis. And they played against some of the most well-known teams, women's teams in the Midwest, and beat them all handily, so that the press labeled them, accurately so, world champions. So they're a very famous team. They, when that book came out, that not my book, but the book by PV and Smith, it got a lot of attention in Montana. It was a source of great pride for the tribes in Montana, because the girls at Fort Shaw came from many different tribes in Montana. And it's a great source of pride for those families. So that's an important part of the story that I tell, although that's told much more extensively in that previous book.
Yeah, your book covers, it's not just a Montana book. It's the rise of American Indian basketball. But I kind of want to save it for the next segment, the impact that Native Americans have had on the sport itself. But pretty much cross-tribal when it comes to the love of the sport?
Yeah, and that's another thing that makes basketball stand out. In certain Native communities, like in the Northeast, lacrosse is still very meaningful. There are some Native communities, especially the Southeast, where baseball has kind of been king for a long time and still is to some degree. Obviously, football is popular, going back to the great Carlisle teams with Jim Thorpe and so on early on. Rodeo, big in a lot of Native communities, but basketball is the one that crosses most geographic boundaries. So I focus on its rise amongst Lumbee people in North Carolina, and the furthest east and the furthest west I take it is talking about basketball being played up in Alaska. So it's coast to coast. It crosses every tribal boundary. It's not always the most popular. It usually is, but it's always at least second.
I'm always curious about do they compete? I got to take a break here, but do they compete amongst each other as to who is the best at the sport in the tribes? We'll talk more. Wade Davies is with us, professor of Native American Studies, University of Montana, Native Hoops, here today on Voices of Montana.
As we pay tribute to our nation's heroes during Veterans Month, AARP Montana wants to thank all those in uniform, along with their families, for their service and sacrifice. As a way of expressing gratitude for defending our freedom, AARP has set up a special free resource site dedicated to Montana veterans and military families. Because veterans often face a unique set of challenges as they age or retire. Find this special free resource site online at aarp.org/mtvets.
Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball, 1895 to 1970. It's one of those long titles, but there's probably an awful lot to unpack here when you look at the impact that Native Americans have had on the sport, the impact the sport has had on our Native American brothers and sisters. Professor Wade Davies is with us, Native American Studies at the University of Montana and author of the book. Wade, I appreciate you being here. I'm kind of curious to talk about that competition level amongst the tribes themselves. And we still have, Native American shootouts and tournaments that are specifically directed toward our tribes in Montana.
Yeah. So a big theme of the book is basketball kind of going down to two tracks. One track is that basketball has been important in the history of the Indian country because of the way that it allows Native people and always has allowed Native people to compete against non-Natives nationally, state level, worldwide, in a way to assert themselves on that kind of stage, a multiracial, multi-ethnic stage. But the other track always has been Native peoples using basketball to compete amongst themselves. And that goes back, again, deep roots that a lot of the sports that tribes have always played, including lacrosse in ancient times, one of the reasons they were played quite often was to do battle, one tribe against another. And battle in a way that was vigorous and dangerous, but obviously not as deadly as all-out warfare. And so by competing through athletics, tribes have have resolved disputes in the past. They've shown their prowess in the past. And so that tradition was already there. And so when basketball was introduced into their communities, they turned it to the same purpose in many cases. And so early on, the most likely way that one tribe would play another or one Native community would play another was in tournaments that the boarding schools would run. And there were some large tournaments early on. One of the biggest was in Rapid City, South Dakota in 1929. People came from all kinds of boarding schools throughout that region to play against each other. But then later on, then they began to compete intertribally through the high school ranks. So as more and more Native youth in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s started to transition into public schools and away from those old boarding schools, then they entered high school level competition and would play in state tournaments. And there was no guarantee that their opponents would be Native, but in some cases they were. And so, for example, in 1935, in the Class B championship, Poplar played Lodgegrass. So teams from predominantly Native high schools in Montana competed against each other on that stage. So that was a way that they could still play that tribe versus tribe for that pride. Later on, as you just pointed out, these big tournaments started to spring up that Native peoples ran themselves. They sponsored them themselves. They invited teams, whether they were high school teams or just independent teams from across the country. There was a big tournament that used to run in, and still does, down in New Mexico and Albuquerque. A big tournament that still runs amongst the Lakota and South Dakota. And then some that have an even more national reach than that. So basketball to this day is a way that one tribe can compete with pride against another. It not only to show, not necessarily to show who's better, but sometimes also to form bonds across tribal lines. Basketball is one of those things that brings Indian country together. Powwow is another example of something that does that. Rodeo can do that as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a big part of the story.
Well, okay, and so you've probably been asked this question. And as I mentioned, the 12 tribal nations, I'm going to mention them, Assiniboine, Blackfoot, the Chippewa, the Cree, the Crow, the Gros Ventre, the Kootenai, the Little Shell, Chippewa, Northern Cheyenne, Ponderay, Salish, and Sioux. Who among those in Montana, I was going to say, has the most basketball prowess? Or who among those thinks they have the most basketball prowess? Because I imagine you've been asked that question.
I have, and the answer to the last part is probably everybody thinks that they have the most prowess. That's natural. I don't focus much on recent decades, so I won't answer it for the past 50 years. But okay, Going back early 20th century, mid-20th century, definitely teams coming off the Crow Reservation were some of the most competitive, especially from the town of Lodgegrass. That they had in the early high school years, they were always competitive. They were always favorites. More recently, teams from the Flathead Reservation, Salish, Kootenai, Ponderay teams have been excellent, but I could find teams from every reservation, Blackfeet, Northern Cheyenne, and others as well.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't feel comfortable saying recently who's the best. I'd get myself in a lot of trouble, I'm sure.
I know. And I tried to do that to you, too.
Yeah.
All right, stand by. I want to come on back and talk more about that history and also launch into the impact Native Americans have had on the sport. It's a reciprocal relationship when we talk about Native American hoops and the American sport of basketball. Back more with Professor Wade Davies from the University of Montana in just a bit after these headlines from Brian Bennett.
My son is not some statistic.
My daughter's not a headline.
My girl, she's not someone's agenda.
What
she is
irreplaceable.
COVID hospitalizations of young people have
tripled since the start of summer.
So I talked to my daughter's doctor about COVID vaccines.
And she said they're highly effective in preventing hospitalizations
and deaths, even from the Delta variant.
We can do this. Find vaccines near you at vaccines.gov. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
took 20 years to research this book. It probably could have taken maybe a little less longer, but Wade Davies is with us here, the author of Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball, 1895 to 1970. I want to get to that too, Professor, as to, you know, why or how long it took you to compile the information in this. But let's get to one of the things I think that is also key in this book is the impact that we talked about a little bit that basketball has had on our Native American brothers and sisters, but it, vice versa. They have had a big impact on the sport of basketball.
Absolutely. So, yeah, a big theme also is the way they played, the way they competed, and how Native teams injected a lot of energy into the sport of basketball and helped make it what it is today. I wouldn't single them out as doing this alone, but they have a far greater impact on the game than you would expect from the numbers of people involved. And that goes back, again, right to the start. So in the early 1900s, there's a lot of coverage in the press of Native teams at a time when Native Americans didn't get much positive coverage, if any, in the press. A lot of these basketball teams did, Fort Shaw being one of them on the women's side. On the men's side, there were some teams from Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas that really stood out. But pretty much across the board, all over the map, there were Native teams that were known for playing in a certain way. And early on, the sport of basketball would have been pretty dull to modern eyes. It was slow moving. There was a center jump after every score. Games would be sometimes like 6-0 would be a final score in some of these games. Kind of a dull, methodical passing game, very little dribbling.
You can say that again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Indian people started to play it differently. They were noted for their speed. Number one thing they were commenting that reporters would comment on is how fast these teams were. So even before there was a term like fast break, a lot of these teams like Haskell were running that fast break. So was Fort Shaw. They'd get the ball and they'd get it down the other end and put up a shot as quick as they could. James Naismith, even in his memoirs, singled out Native teams amongst all the groups he could talk about to say how inspiring and how quick and how exciting their style of play was compared to other people. In fact, he even cited that was how he meant the game to be played, not the way a lot of non-natives were playing the game in the early 1900s, throwing their weight around, really methodically moving the ball. He loved the way these Native teams played, and he even singled out some of them. There was a player early on named Chauncey Arquette and another one named Lewis Weller that he wrote about in his book, and he singled these guys out for dribbling like nobody had ever dribbled the ball before, for their speed, for how quickly they could pass. A lot of these Native teams were also known for kind of an uncanny level of teamwork. Without speaking to each other and without drawing up plays, they could move the ball around and just befuddle their opponents. So,
Wade, stand by with the soul because we'll come on back. Got a breakup coming here. We'll talk more about that impact as we continue on. Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball on Voices.
Voices of Montana continues right after this. As telecom manager at a health insurance plan, Carl does what's required.
I run a fully automated phone tree that keeps our members from ever having to speak to a human. Hey, I do what's required.
At Pacific Source Health Plans, we go beyond what's required. Instead of automated phone trees, we have real people answering our members' calls in an average of 30 seconds, which means you'll always speak with a person who can help. Pacific Source Health Plans, members first.
Professor Davies, I appreciate you being here. More on this impact, because... And in your book, you call it res ball. Is that res ball, a reservation ball? Is that a politically correct term now? Is that okay?
Yeah, it's a widely used term. It doesn't appear as that term until about the 1980s. First, you see reservation ball being used, then res ball starts to become the common term, which doesn't mean that every Native team plays that style, but it's that faster, fast-breaking, rapid style. And as I was saying before, the price that goes back to those very early teams that are playing in the early 1900s in the boarding schools. They got a lot of attention for it. Some of them really stood out in the states where they played. And another team would be a team from St. Francis Mission in South Dakota, which was a predominantly Lakota team that played through the 1930s. And they would get invited to national tournaments in Chicago and just wow the crowds. They'd inevitably be the fan favorites. So it's that style that was very thrilling that they were playing. There were also some other teams, certain African-American teams that were playing that way, you know, before mid-century. But these native teams then really helped inject that style into the game of basketball. Other teams started to mimic it to some degree. They don't single-handedly create what basketball is today, but they have a large role. They have a large role in making it the exciting game it is now, not the methodical game it was at the beginning. And to some degree, there's evidence of high school coaches and coaches at other levels in like the 1950s, 60s, trying to mimic that style, never quite pulling it off to the same degree.
Is it a sensitive subject? Well, I think it is a sensitive subject when you talk about Native American sports or Native Americans being successful in the college ranks or in the pro ranks. And I think we've made progress in that regard. Does your book approach that?
Yeah, it does. So college was a tough nut to crack. So part of the problem there is the talent was definitely there. Yeah. And there were some colleges that were interested, but 1940s, 1950s, that era, it was very difficult for Native athletes to get into college. Racial reasons, racist reasons, also economic reasons, cultural reasons. Biases that some coaches had against Native players, which I think is still the case in many cases, just assuming that they wouldn't stick with it, they wouldn't stay their 4 years. Unfair biases in other regards, too. So college was always difficult. There were a few bright spots, especially in Oklahoma. Abe Lemons at Oklahoma City University during the 50s and 60s recruited a lot of great Native players, but a lot of other places, coaches just wouldn't recruit them. And so college was difficult, and that made making the pros difficult. Although probably my favorite part of the research was finding all of these barnstorming teams in the 20s, 30s, 40s. So professional players, but not in any league, similar to the Harlem Globetrotters, and in fact, quite often inspired by the Globetrotters, that were crisscrossing the country. One of them, in fact, that Jim Thorpe, famous athlete, world-class athlete Jim Thorpe, later in his career ran a team he called the World Famous Indians, a barnstorming pro team that would tour all throughout the Midwest and other areas. So there were men, this was largely shut off to women, but there were Native men throughout the 20th century playing for pay, but not in the NBA. There's been very few that made it to the NBA, and that's still largely the case.
Yeah, I appreciate the telling of that story. So you said that's one of your favorite aspects in the research, the 20 years of research, Professor Davies. That's an awful long time. Why?
Well, it's because I wanted to tell this story as fully as I could. So I didn't just want to focus on one team, or I didn't just want to focus on one level of play. I focus on everything from playground, pickup basketball, through professional basketball and everything in between there. And I also wanted to look the entire country, and that was a lot to bite off. And most of what I was able to uncover, some of that's through oral interviews with various people that were kind enough to speak to me. A lot of that was work in the archives, national archives all over the country to study what's going on in the boarding schools. And a ton of it was newspapers, just hundreds. Actually, I would say thousands and thousands of newspaper articles that I'm having to trace these teams. And it takes a long time. So it wouldn't be quite accurate to say I was researching nonstop 24/7.
Yeah.
It's one of those projects that you work on it for a while and then you throw up your hands and say, I'll never be able to finish this. It's too big. And so I'd get distracted, as life does, and then I'd come back to it. But yeah, it wasn't the type of project that you could just devote a year to and finish it.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. But you've had a lot of high praise for this.
Yeah, and that feels great. You don't necessarily expect that. You don't know if you're going to get it. You know, sometimes you can work really hard at something and never hear anything about it. But that was very pleasing. In fact, for me, this book, more than anything I've ever done, it means something to me because I know how much of myself I put into it for so long. So that's a great feeling.
You've written other stories as well, and I kind of want to save time for one here called Healing Ways because that's one of your interests as well. Navajo efforts to utilize traditional and Western healing medicine. Navajo healthcare in the 20th century. I'm gonna save some time for that. There's a couple of other things just to mention them. We Are Still Here, American Indian Since 1890. That was with Peter Iverson, and then American Indian Sovereignty and Law, an annotated bibliography with Richmond Clow. So, just to get people aware of that, Wade Davis is a professor in Native American Studies at the University of Montana. It's really hard to leave this topic because I think there's a ton more to look at here in that long research period. And if people were to ask you, you know, what's your takeaway? What changed from day one when you thought I needed to do this book to day two when I said this book is finished in you?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I had no idea when I started this, all the places it would take me. As I said, those professional teams, for instance, I had no idea that any of them existed. I had some inkling how important basketball was amongst Native women, but the deeper I got into that, the more prominent that became as part of the story. The idea about the influence on the style, you know, that was one of those things where I wondered going in, but I never heard anything about that. And then digging into that and seeing that it's just this continual evolution over decade after decade. It was all a journey, most of which was unexpected and that seemed like it would never end for me in the research. So it's an odd feeling actually to have it done, have it out there.
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Done? Okay, because, you know, in 1970, there's still more to write there, huh, Professor?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. And it's one of those things where I was hoping this would be out there and inspire other people. It would be kind of a foundation for some other scholars to then tell the rest of the story, other parts of the story. So right now I don't have plans to take that up to the present, but I think it would be great if somebody did.
Yeah, I totally get that. All right, come on back. We just want to talk a little bit about that other title that I had referenced, Healing Ways, too, because I'm curious about that. Professor Wade Davis is with us, Native American Studies at the University of Montana. So back with more in a bit. Chronic wasting disease surveillance is happening in specific priority surveillance areas across the state. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks reminds hunters that if you harvest a deer, moose, or elk in those areas, please stop at a CWD sampling station. Head to fwp.mt.gov/CWD for more information on sampling, testing, and disposal.
General season is here. In 2021, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks will continue CWD surveillance in specific priority surveillance areas in northwestern, north central, southwestern, and south central Montana. If you harvest a deer, elk, or moose in these areas, please stop at a CWD sampling station for free testing. For station locations, assistance with sampling your animal, and proper carcass disposal, visit fwp.mt.gov/CWD.
Always encouraged to shop your local bookstores, the mom-and-pop bookstores. Those are always cool if you're looking for books like Native Hoops, The Rise of American Indian Basketball, 1895 to 1970. Wade Davis has been with us here. We continue on. He's professor of Native American Studies at the University of Montana. Really appreciated the conversation. There was more here I had on the table because I like to explore, the other aspects of Native sports. We didn't talk a ton about the boarding schools and the effect that had culturally. But I want to move on a little bit here because medicine, I think, as well, is a big part of our Native culture here. And you wrote a book, Healing Ways, Navajo Healthcare in the 20th Century. What are some of the takeaways from that?
Yeah, that was an earlier book, and actually that book helped give rise to this book, because as well I was interviewing people for that book that I kind of really realized how important basketball was, even to these doctors and nurses that I talked about. But anyway, that book is somewhat similar in the sense that it's about Indian people, Native communities, taking something that comes to them from the outside and embracing it and asserting themselves through it. So the book is really about how Navajo people traditionally have held on to their traditions, their traditional ways of healing, herbalism, ceremonies, and really strongly advocated for being able to maintain that while also being able to have access to quality health care, especially through what's called the Indian Health Service, which is the federal agency that delivers that. It's not all a positive story. Obviously, there's a history of oftentimes neglect and cultural conflict, but like Native Hoops, it's largely positive about the possibilities when Native communities adapt and assert themselves and really take hold of something and advocate for it.
And I know that they have been resistant for a lot of various reasons to traditional medicine. And I know that they incorporate that to a certain degree as well. Traditional medicine has incorporated a lot of those healing practices that have come from our Native Americans, correct?
Yeah, correct. And also, depending on the era, depending on who we're talking about, there have been physicians, some of them who are Navajo, who then become physicians themselves and work in hospitals and so on, that understand the importance of these traditional worldviews and forms of healing to their patients. And they're not only respectful of them, but they try to find ways to blend those. And that's a big part of the story.
Is it as strong as ever today, the traditional healing methods in our Native American culture?
That's really going to depend on the community. In the Navajo Nation, which I studied, that's the largest reservation in the country. It's the largest reservation-based population in the country. They've of course, had a lot of traumatic events in their history, but they've done very well at holding on to their language, which is also involved in the traditional healing, and to their ceremonies and to their healing ways, to borrow from the title of the book. They've been very successful at that, although not entirely so. Other communities that maybe don't have a reservation, have smaller populations, that they've had other challenges. So it's not always going to be the case, but that commitment to those traditional ways is very widespread in Native communities.
That book written in 2001, you have 10 seconds, sorry about that. What are one of those practices that you learned in that book that you still do today?
I don't do the practices myself, but I guess the practice would be in doing research and just listening to people and listening to their stories and seeing what really matters to them and then taking my research in that direction. I guess that would be the practice.
Well, thank you. That's really cool. I think we do a lot more. We need a lot more of listening and measuring our words and letting our voices be heard. Dr. Wade Davies, thank you. Be well, sir. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, thank you very much. This has been great.